Welcome to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and by Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine. I'm John Lawson. My guests today are poets Richard St. John and Jay Carson. Jay Carson retired from the English faculty here at Robert Morris a couple of years ago and has been publishing poetry like a house on fire. More than 70 of his poems have appeared in local and national literary journals, magazines, and anthologies. Jay authored a chapbook, Irish Coffee, published by Coal Hill Review, and a full-length book of his poems, The Cinnamon of Desire, which was published by Main Street Rag. Welcome home, Jay.
Thank you, John. It is a triple pleasure to be here today, to be back at Robert Morris, to be able to see you, and to be able to be here with Rick and hear some of his wonderful work.
I fully concur. Richard St. John, known to us as Rick, is also no stranger to RMU. He's read here on several occasions, and his work has been published in Rune, among many other venues, including Sewanee Review, Poet Lore, and Chautauqua, as well as many other periodicals and anthologies. Rick's books include The Pure Inconstancy of Grace, published in 2005 by Truman State University Press as first runner-up for the T.S. Eliot Prize for Poetry, Shrine, a long poem released as a chapbook in 2011, and most recently, Each Perfected Name, just published by Truman State University Press. Richard St. John, welcome back to Robert Morris.
All right, well, thank you for inviting both of us.
We've agreed that this interview will focus primarily on Rick's work since his new collection has just hit the stand, so to speak. So let's start with a poem by Rick, and I'd like to ask you to read one from the new book, Each Perfected Name.
Okay, excuse me. Well, this is kind of a poem a little bit about our sort of longing to be renewed, as one passage has it, being born again from above, but not in some narrow fundamentalist kind of way, but in the way that we all need to be kind of renewed over and over again all our lives. And so this is the poem set during a trip back home to visit family, and there are three characters. There's my mom, who was suffering from Alzheimer's, and my younger sister, who has Down syndrome, and the two of them have lived in the same house for 50 years. And then the third character is our family cat, who's named Kit, or Christopher Smart, Christopher Kit Smart, after the 18th century British poet. And Smart was put in a madhouse for religious mania. And among other things, he would compel his friends to get down on the street with him and pray. You can imagine how well that went over. But while he was in the incarcerated or in the madhouse, he also had his cat with him. And one of his most anthologized pieces is a part of a very long poem, but it's in praise of his cat. So, and the cat gave him a lot of solace while he was there. So, okay, this poem is called Second Birth. And it starts with a little epigraph. I would as lief pray with Kit Smart as with any man. Samuel Johnson. My mother is upstairs, in her bedroom crammed with tracts and books on prayer. My sister with Down syndrome is up there too. Their voices filter through the cheap construction. Not words, it's mostly tone. Though I managed to hear, Mother, you have to put the drops in your eyes. They go back and forth, a gusty wind, the intimate, incomprehensible language of childhood twins. Tonight, everything seems to be speaking to my blindness and need. Her weekly pillbox, its mornings and evenings, making one day. That childish cross-stitch of a lamb. Even our old cat, Kit Smart, throws himself down on the fake flagstone flooring, beseeching me to pray. Mewp, mewp, he says. All I catch is tone. My mother and sister are still going on. 20 minutes it's been. No, really, 50 years. Their shared laboring converges as our mom grows young again. This may seem a little strange, my sister told me on the phone. Sometimes we make animal sounds. Moo, moo. Ba, ba. The drops are still not in, but the voices come through the thin drywall, less a dispute than a well-worn vaudeville act. Tendentious at times, yet they're clearly yucking it up. "Mupe, mupe," says Kit Smart, his glowing eyes at the foot of the sofa bed. "Mupe, mupe," I reply.
That was my guest, Richard St. John, reading his poem Second Birth from his new collection, Each Perfected Name. Wow. Love it. What can I say, Rick?
Thanks.
Second Birth. Ezra Pound said of T.S. Eliot after Eliot died, he was the true Dantescan voice of his generation. And it often seems to me that you are the true Eliotian voice of your generation, of our time. The religious themes here remind me so much of Eliot, and I love the way that you bring that religious element of life out in the common events of every day.
Well, I confessed early on, just when I was in high school, and maybe early years of college, I did have kind of an Eliot infatuation. I think I moved beyond to a lot of other people. And I am also a big fan of Dante, but that's a separate story. But I think of religion as a symbol system, you know? And, you know, the question is, you know, what do we do with these symbol systems? And we hope that they're things that, you know, point us toward mysteries and help us move through the world, and also ideally help us be more excellently human. But I don't look at this at all in terms of dogma or trying to think of anybody, trying to get anybody to believe a set of beliefs. In fact, I think that's kind of distracting from the more important role of religions as symbol systems.
Indeed. I struggle with religious dogma and doctrine myself. In fact, I have ended up at a place of total rejection of the above. But your poetry evokes for me a kind of religious sensibility that seems to be irrelevant to dogma.
My sense is that, you know, faith is not about some set of beliefs, you know, that we check off, you know, I agree with this, I agree with that, but really, it's much more about fidelity. You know, what are we leaning toward? What do we hearken toward?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's where it really matters. What are we going to do with whatever tradition we find ourselves in? You know, and that's the key issue, not an easy one.
And I think, as you pointed out earlier, John, that what is remarkable to me about Rick's work is that I so quickly pass over the little mysteries in our lives, like cats talking and people talking like animals, how that draws them together, and we're all drawn together there, and how Rick picks that up, and how his own participation encourages the readers, I think.
What that last half line says, mupe, mupe, I reply. You know, you've adopted the language of the animals. What that says about what language is.
And our own inability to say what we mean. I mean, what do we mean? You know, it's complicated, and sometimes I find myself just going, mupe, mupe.
Yeah, exactly. And yet so funny, too. Not just serious.
Complicated and in some ways very simple. Mm-hmm. That we're just, you know, all we have to do is reach out and touch in some way.
Jay Carson, I wonder if you would read us a poem now.
Well, I would be delighted. This is a little change up, you might say. I'm not nearly so subtle.
I'll go on.
Okay, all right, I'll just read. This is called Good Friday. That smoky spring morning reminded me of fall, heartbreaking in its promise and surety of end. It was Good Friday, before Jesus' inheritance, when it was all on the come. His bet and belief way back then, and mine, that it would be okay, even though I was 19 and mostly wondering the oxygen of women and why my miracles always tasted of bourbon. One latest busy question. Why stop at red lights? I dealt the traffic tickets in a semicircle on my brother's kitchen table, like blasphemous apostles, while he finished the cigar he had lit at the police station for our confidence. 8 stop signs, 3 stop lights, and a weak little too fast for conditions. 2 screaming days later, I dutifully drove them and a sack of dollars out of my parents' house downtown to the fixer, my uncle, who got sober with Blackie Riley, really. If you would only come to me sooner, I'd date the secretary. Could have had it stopped right there, free. But now I'll have to deal with the Greek, and believe me, it will cost. All that help, and they're all dead. After the moth flies and the rust corrupts, we really are all a better family.
Wow. That was Good Friday, read by its author, Jay Carson. A slightly different take on religious themes. And yet, both poems, yours and Rick's, rooted in family.
Mm-hmm. Rick, Good Friday was always a big time. I was raised as an Irish Catholic. That's the first name of Irish Catholic, as I was raised as. And it was kind of a big thing. I had an aunt who was a nun, and she'd come by sometimes, and we were expected to go to church for 3 hours on Good Friday. And that was actually the day in which I went down to meet my uncle. And it was kind of striking to me, remembering the what I think you both were just talking about, what the formalizations of religion versus what was really going on in my life. And yet, at the same time, things were emerging that were spiritual, that these things that were happening were maybe not best for me or for them. But how were we to learn except in that way?
The uncle, the fixer, becomes a kind of religious figure in a way.
Exactly. I read that the other day, and somebody came up and said, "I remember Blackie Riley." That's always a nice feeling.
Yeah.
I love that sense of community existing.
Your poetry also often evokes Pittsburgh specifically. You're like a fifth generation Pittsburgher?
Seventh.
Seventh, yeah. I knew it was an odd number.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, I'm always interested in the creative process. As you're writing, are you conscious of other poetry?
Often, you know, I'll start my own little ritual sessions to sort of get myself writing by trying to read somebody else's work and trying to get in a zone of gratitude, just being grateful for the, you know, good work that other people have done. And then, you know, reading throughout the tradition also is important because it gives you a sense of what your options are in terms of, you know, style choices or choices of verse or voice or, you know, it gives you just a sense of range. And so it's that is always in the background. But although I think my poems, and I might come back to this a little bit, are in the danger of being a little overly literary, I really try and start with what I call a felt difficulty. Something that I need to work out for myself or something that's a sticking point for me. And then it's really a matter of trying to feel my way toward, you know, what's the material that authentically goes with that thing that I want to work out, and can I make something out of it that helps shed a little bit of light, primarily for myself, but maybe for a reader too. And I hope that there's always at least an emotional through line so that there's something really felt coming through in the poem.
Interesting. Who are you reading right now?
Oh, right now, I'd say one of my big favorite guys is poet Frank X. Gaspar, who grew up in a Portuguese working class family in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And he's really an omnivorous religious reader, so he's kind of up my alley, but just a wonderful, wonderful guy. And then just over lunch I was telling Jay about another poet I've returned to recently, a guy, B.H. Fairchild, who grew up in this very small town of Liberal, Kansas. And he just has these wonderful coming-of-age poems of just a kid trying to figure out what's my life going to be in the midst of this kind of oil field kind of town.
Boy, if I've ever heard an oxymoron, Liberal Kansas has got to be right up there with
it. Yeah, well, it was an oxymoron, as his poems make clear.
Yeah, well, interesting.
They're both wonderful poets.
Glad to know both of those names, Gaspar and Fairchild.
Yeah.
How about you, Jay? How do other writers fit into your creative process?
I'm never crazy about that question because I just don't know. I am a big believer, as I think Rick was suggesting at one part of his discussion, in poetry as sort of problem solving. It's rhetoric, which was my background in education, is for our argument with others. Poetry is for our argument with ourselves. So that's really where I start. I do read other poets. I was looking at Neruda and, of all combinations, Whitman yesterday.
Wow.
But I'm not sure that they inform content. And I think they probably inform the rhythms I might have and the style that I might have. And I'm a big Dylan fan. I think that Dylan is, who is it, the poet laureate of England calls him the best poet and writing in the world today.
Gosh, I've lost track of who the current poet laureate is. Actually.
I think this, did they do one every year like we do?
I think they're 10 years or longer.
Yeah, so this would be the same one then, I think.
The same one, I don't know.
Right.
We're all stumbling around this
right.
Yes.
Out there in radio land, mark that down.
let's move back to a reading by Rick then.
Well, I mentioned my fear that my poems might seem kind of overly literary or overly intellectual, but I really am a believer that the life of the mind and the life of the heart are really of a piece. But I'm going to read a poem that sort of explores that terrain. I've been reading an excerpt from Wordsworth's long poem, The Prelude, but this was a little piece from an anthology. But it was really moving, and it really felt important to me. But at the same time, I found myself wondering, is this just too much circling around inside my brain? Does this make any difference in the real world? And I was thinking about all that and wrestling with it. I sort of felt there was a poem there, and I didn't know where it was going to go until some friends of mine told me about their dog, their old dog, and an incident with the dog. And the dog's name was Einstein. And that really kind of got me going. So this poem's called Inner Ear. He was an old dog, Einstein, gradually going blind, already deaf as a post. They found him one night, turning inexplicably in useless, lurching circles. My good friend recalls lifting him into the car, the musk of his dampened Airedale fur. But it wasn't a stroke, something rather with his inner ear. In only a week, he was back to his normal halting walk, though with an unaccustomed, gentle look, as if he could hear again, but listen to something far beyond them now. Oh, the Lord is subtle, subtle. Einstein at a blackboard chalked with dense equations. I'm thinking of this on an aimless, circling walk, thinking of Wordsworth, too, wondering if it matters that one moonlit night he steals a rowboat tied to a willow tree, then rows with adolescent hubris toward a far, fixed point. Suddenly, a huge peak, black and huge, rises in his sight, strides after him and turns him back, leaving just a dim and undetermined sense of unknown modes of being. That's when, from the rolled-down window of a slate-gray SUV, a man leans out, his wife in a sari. The tunnel,
It is blocked entirely. They need directions, not poor Wordsworth turning round his boat. So I talk them through a route. Yet, however practical their plea, they're looking for the Hindu temple, its tower, a ziggurat, glowing gold and white above the interstate, a realm of deities unknown to me. I find one in a book, who on his journey toward enlightenment is told he cannot bring his old dog with him, too. The faithful beast looks up from licking at his cracked and bleeding paws and cocks his ears. Yudhisthira ponders 7 days, then picks his way as he descends the mountain path with Dharma limping at his side. But now the craggy landscape's different, as if the whole supporting universe had been, ever so subtly, bent.
That was my guest, Richard St. John, reading his poem, Inner Ear. Wow. That image of the couple looking for the Hindu temple reminds me of Yukio Mishima's novel, The Temple of the Golden Pavilion. Have you ever read
that? No, Mishima? I have not, no.
There's a beautiful Paul Schrader movie about Mishima. I think it's just called Mishima, A Life in Four Chapters. And they dramatize several of his works. And The Temple of the Golden Pavilion involves a boy who's a stutterer and very conscious of his imperfection as a human being, and he's haunted in the same way that Wordsworth was by that mountain in your poem. He's haunted by the image of perfection that this golden pavilion represents to him, to the point that he actually has to go burn it down. And I often think that's my orientation to religion in general. I'm so haunted by this quest for perfection that I will obviously never come near to, that I have to burn it down myself. This poem reminds me of that so much, this interplay of the perfection and our consciousness that we won't achieve it. Well, now that I've dominated that conversation, a beautiful, evocative poem. And I love your use of Wordsworth there.
That's circling around. It's just so well. You have the dog circling, and then you have the ideas circling so beautifully. It's just it's one of my favorite poems. Certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, I do find that perplexing. How, on one hand, you know, you say, well, what goes on in your mind is just, you know, just internal, as my mother-in-law says to me. You can't plow a field by turning it over in your mind. And yet, at the same time, that's those little changes in the way we look at the world transform the world. And so it's kind of one of those both ands.
So right.
You know, it's life is just full of these paradoxes where both halves are just equally true.
Yep. And at the very least, you've got to turn it over in your mind before you can turn it over in reality.
Yeah.
Rick, you are recently back from a bit of a mini tour apropos of the release of your new book, and that makes me think about what you were just talking about, you know, the intellectuality of your poems, and I'm wondering how the idea of actually performing influences your writing, if at all.
Well, I think it's helpful in a number of regards, and the first is it's an opportunity to actually connect with audiences, because, you know, there you are working on a poem, and, you know, it's just wonderful to get out and, you know, have it heard by real people, and that makes you think a little bit in the writing about all the things that a reader or a listener is going to care about: the sound of a poem, the pacing of a poem. Are you giving them information at the right, you know, in ways that it can be digested, but is still surprising, and just, you know, is it interesting to somebody? And then the other flip side of how that works is when you're there face to face with people and you're reading something and it's feeling flat, you know it, and, you know, and it makes you think hard about, well, am I going to actually, you know, put that in a book or do something or just throw it in a drawer and come back to it later and hope that you can find a new way to approach it.
Yes.
Or hope if it's already in a book, people won't pay too much attention
well, there's
to
that.
It.
Yeah. Actually, I've done some of my most profound poetic revisions waiting to read and reading through my stuff in advance and realizing, oh, that's going to sound terrible. I've got to change it now.
Been there.
Yep. So where are we? Where did you go? What kind of promotion is involved in a new work of?
Okay, well, I've, you know, one of my first moves was to, you know, schedule a couple of little book launch things here in Pittsburgh, and then I also contacted people that I know at various universities, including yourself, who, you know, and that kindly led to this, you know, opportunity to get together, but I haven't been on the road a whole lot with this new book, partly because I was recently in an automobile accident, was hit by a car. But recently I was in Queens, New York, at Queensborough Community College, and gave a little talk there about poetry and empathy, which gets us back to this discussion we were having a little bit about human connections. So I kind of talked to them about some of my ideas about, well, not particular to me, but the idea of poetry as many ways to look at poetry, but one of them is to think of it as truth-telling, kind of telling the truth that's the truth of human experience in contrast to math and science that give us, you know, a lot of useful information about the world. But poetry is giving us a little sense of what's it like to be alive as a person, not as a science experiment or as an equation. And so, you know, I talked a little bit about that, and then also talked with them about, well, you know, in that context, forgive me, I'm going on here, but, you know, it's about truth-telling, but it's also made up, and, you know, it's invented, but even that, you know, invention grows out of the lived soil of the poet's experience. And then, because it always really gets me crazy when people talk about poetry as being soft or ineffective or something, I also talked to them a little bit about Kenneth Burke's phrase, literature as equipment for living. And I really think poetry really works as equipment for living. It holds and distills complex experience, and because it holds human experience, it can be a way that we study what I call comparative humanity, and get a sense of the deep commonalities that we share as people across time and culture, but also the illuminating differences. And then poetry also evokes things from us, and that's a useful part of equipment for living.
Yeah. You're mentioning empathy reminds me of an NPR show I heard over the weekend in which it was some social science, you know, research was reported that held that we become empathetic by engaging in rough and tumble activities with other children. And ironically, it seems to be a turning point, according to this research, in developing empathy, that we have to hurt somebody to develop it. We have to hurt them at a proper developmental point in our lives and realize that we have hurt them, and think to ourselves, I'll never do that again. I know what that feels like, and I'm sorry. I'm not sure what that has to do with anything you just said, but...
Well, I mean, that is an important moment, the moment where you realize, okay, and Jay's got a wonderful poem about that. I don't know if he's going to read that today, but you know, those moments are important. And then from that point on, when you sort of make this connection of, okay, I feel pain, other people feel pain, then the world of literature is a way of opening up all kinds of other lives that you can't experience for yourself, but once you've had that moment, you can say, oh, well, I haven't experienced that, but I can try and live into it a little bit.
Yes.
And I think that's just very important, forgive me, I'm going to go back to this theme about how it grinds me that people talk about poetry as if it wasn't important, because Plato, in his Republic, he wants to kick the poets out, but why does he want to kick the poets out of his Republic? it's not because they're soft or ineffectual. It's because they're going to get people too active and get people doing things that they wouldn't do in his perfect rational universe. You know, so I keep the poets in there and just realize we're not as much dupes as he maybe thinks we are when we're reading the experience we come across in literature. We can say we can embrace that, or we can look at another person's experience and set it a little bit at a distance, or we can ask questions of it. But I just think it's enormously important.
I'm glad we agree. Well, since we do agree, why don't we transition then to your next poem?
Okay. All right. So I'm going to read a poem that sort of grows out of the this sort of mix of lived experience and invented experience, and it's called Yet Another Resurrection Appearance, and it's a poem that's also has my mother in it, and again, I mentioned that she had Alzheimer's. But it's also, to me, a poem a little bit about how the divine kind of appears right in the sort of messy physical intimacy of life. So, Yet Another Resurrection Appearance. Now that she's gone to live in another land of deep attunements and forgetfulness, I'm bathing my mother for the first time. She sits, still in sweatpants, on a metal stool in her shower stall. I work downward with an old soft cloth, cupping up warm water with my other hand. First, the knot of her neck, then her back, a mottled brown, the wing-like bones of her shoulder blades. Next, I soap the tender cup of her clavicle. Her breasts now, almost gone, loose and gently leathery. So thin, her ribs seem to count themselves through her skin, and the scar where they made the incision is smoother than a dime. Now that I've laved the silvery water on her skin, touched the bones of her wrists, the hollows of her palms, now that I've set my hand into the cusp, smooth beneath each of her ghostly arms, how could I not believe?
You're listening to RMU Radio's Literature Out Loud. I'm John Lawson, and that was my guest, Richard St. John, reading his poem, Yet Another Resurrection Appearance. Jay Carson,
yes.
Would you favor us with another poem of yours?
I would be delighted. Thank you. That's certainly, I hoped we'd have a little chat in between in the sense that that's a tough poem to follow. It's so great. It's so tender. So excellent. This is a little rougher. This is, it's about belief. It comes from two experiences. One is being in Prague and hearing about the story of the golem, which was an inchoate mass of pre-human that was terrorizing all the children in Prague until Rabbi Lev came along and gave it the word of God. And then it started helping all the children, and they were delighted to have it around. And then, as you'll see in the poem, one day the golem didn't need Rabbi Lev anymore. And finally, there's a reference to Jonestown, which was, of course, the great Kool-Aid massacre in South America, where the cult leader pretended to be working for God. He was actually working for probably the devil. Religion is a terrible thing. Rabbi Lev, they say, tamed the golem, the inchoate earth man who terrorized Prague until the rabbi taught him to be good and protect the children. Until the golem thought he got the word of God in his mouth when Rabbi Lev wasn't there. The golem returned to his unformed state, went berserk, and nearly undid all his good. Three times in my life I've had the word of God in my mouth. When I moved from a Catholic school to a Protestant school, I got into religious arguments trying to help the nicest, most foolish people. The second time, God told me, and I told you, God didn't exist. The third time you probably read about the federal government was involved. My lawyers told me not to talk about it. Three. After Jonestown, I had to go to church. What could even that brilliant priest say about the Kool-Aid communion? I remember his first words. Religion is a terrible thing. Thinking about God is hot and prickly, filled with righteous indignation and controlling. One Rabbi Lev is so hard to hear.
That was Jay Carson reading his poem, Religion is a Terrible Thing.
I wonder if I could follow up on that with that.
Oh, no, no follow-ups allowed.
What that priest said, he said that, I've always been fascinated by this, that most people are worried that there isn't enough religious feeling in the world. He said there's too much. He said that's the problem. Men are too motivated by religion and get in a lot of trouble. The purpose of the major religions in the world, he said, was to civilize that religious instinct.
Wow, that's cool.
I love that. You know.
Yeah. I guess it depends on how you define religion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it probably comes down, at least in part, to identifying religion with a set of dogmas.
I think that's the sort of destructive move when people start thinking it's about a set of beliefs that you either have to agree with or disagree with, and I feel like that just takes you down a whole set of bad paths. Whereas if you're thinking about religion as symbol systems, then the question is, how do you interpret them? You listen deeply to somebody else's symbol system and try and honor it and, you know, hear it clearly and ask genuine questions of it. And all metaphors break down, but I kind of think of it like a little bit like music. There's no disagreement between J.S. Bach and John Coltrane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they resonate differently. They resonate differently for different people. They evoke different things from us, and at best, I'll go back to the phrase I used earlier, at best they teach us different ways to be excellently human. But if you go down this path that you were talking about of, you know, belief and dogma, you just get into disagreement, where if you can say, look, let's listen to each other and how do we become more excellently human, you're into a very different sort of conversation.
Again, I return to that initial poem that you read today, where you talked about not hearing the specific words that your mother and sister were saying. You heard the tone. I think that, again, is the musical analogy that you're making. Gosh, this is fun. Really enjoyed. I could do this all day. But then again, I can't. So let's have a final poem from Rick.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll end with a poem that's set on the winter solstice on a greyhound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, reading a newspaper and then turning to read a play by George Bernard Shaw about St. Joan of Arc, who was, of course, this young French girl religious visionary who became a general and helped the French defeat the British at Orléans. And my sense of when I'm reading the newspaper is that often all of our actions seem to be coming back to haunt us. And there's a fairness to that, a kind of moral symmetry. And that's where this poem starts. But there's also a kind of moment of transformation, and it ends in kind of a different place. So this poem's called Reading Shaw's Play, St. Joan, at the solstice, on a greyhound, heading home. The year comes round again with its own dark fairness. Out on the turnpike, flecks of sleet, lightning through night clouds, ghostly then stark, echo of thunder. In the tabloid at my seat, old scatterings return. Flicker of war in the Congo and Sudan. Late season hurricanes. Tainted meat. All around me, whispered conversations of the poor. Two rows up, a solitary reading lamp. We're making good time, but where? The bus outruns its headlights in the dark, sucking diesel fuel. I turn back to Joan of Arc, where the French cause seems lost, too. No one believes in her, but Joan insists. God speaks to me. I hear his voice. That's your imagination, they reply. Of course, she says. Isn't that how God speaks? It's snow now. Giddy, dizzy flakes are multiplying everywhere. They clean the air, like once when I was lost in abstract speculation, and a good friend asked, can't we cut the crap and just agree we're all together on this bus? At the service stop, we pile out, all of us, laughing. Woman in a burqa holds her daughter up, who points at the wildering white, amazed. Jesus, it's beautiful, a guy with a Rasta cap and dreadlocks says as he catches a snowflake on his outstretched hand. The year, in its fairness, comes round again.
Beautiful. That was my guest, Richard St. John, reading his poem. And this is a long title. Reading Shaw's play, St. Joan at the Solstice on a Greyhound Heading Home. That's from his new collection, Each Perfected Name, published by Truman State University Press. If listeners want to purchase a copy of your book, Rick, how can they do so?
Well, I've belatedly come into the 20th century, and you'll notice I said 20th century, not 21st century.
Yeah.
And I finally have a website, RichardStJohnPoet.com, so all one word. And, you know, you could order a book there or hear about readings and upcoming projects, or you could contact Truman State University Press and order through them.
And Jay Carson, if listeners want to purchase your collection, The Cinnamon of Desire, how can they do that?
Well, they can contact Main Street Rag, or I think it's also on Amazon, and they can also... The trunk of my car is not a bad idea, and in fact, a good time.
All those parking tickets.
In fact, a good time to get there is right after Rick and I read next week. Actually, a little bit after next week, the 18th of April, at the Carnegie Library at 3 p.m. in the poetry room on the second floor, I think, and. We'll have more wonders for them. I'm sure Rick will have other excellent poems, and we can talk and deal there.
Wonderful. You've been listening to Literature Out Loud, sponsored by RMU Radio and by Rune, the Robert Morris University Literary Magazine, which will celebrate its new issue with a reading by Pitt Poetry Series editor Ed O'Chester at the Wheatley Center at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, April 21st. Please come if you can. Thanks to my guests today, Richard St. John and Jay Carson. It's been a real pleasure, gentlemen.
Thanks to you.
Thank you, John.
I'm John Lawson. Thanks for listening.